sermon this morning is entitled Nuts and Bolts. And maybe you think that's something of an odd title, but we're getting to the end of the Corinthians series. And if you wonder how much and how long, this happens to be number 44. So we've been looking at the troubled church for a period of time. But I think it's a fruitful study because each and every church has some kind of trouble in it at one time or another. And it's inevitable when you get human people together that there's going to be some form of trouble sooner or later. So I want to read in your hearing verses 1 through 12, chapter 16. Now concerning the collection for the saints, as I directed the churches of Galatia, so do you also. On the first day of every week, each one of you is to put aside and save as he may prosper, so no collections be made when I come. When I arrive, whomever you may approve, I will send them with letters to carry your gift to Jerusalem. And if it's fitting for me to go also, they will go with me. But I will come to you after I go through Macedonia, for I am going through Macedonia. And perhaps I will stay with you or even spend the winter so that you may send me on my way wherever I may go. For I do not wish to see you now just in passing, for I hope to remain with you for some time, if the Lord permits. But I will remain in Ephesus until Pentecost. For a wide door for effective service is open to me, and there are many adversaries. Now if Timothy comes, see that he is with you without cause to be afraid, for he is doing the Lord's work as I also am. So let no one despise him, but send him on his way in peace, so that he may come to me, for I expect him with the brethren. But concerning Apollos, our brother, I encouraged him greatly to come to you with the brethren, and it was not at all his desire to come now, but he will come when he has opportunity. Now, at the end of Paul's letters, you often find a section that I would call nuts and bolts. Such things as practical advice, greetings, instructions, notice of his plans or itinerary, where he's going, recommendations for other Christian workers, work-related items. But no section in Paul's letters is found lacking in doctrine or reproof. You know, they peek out like gold nuggets in the gravel of a stream when you're panning. And so I think when we look at this in the last chapter of this letter to Corinth, you're going to find all these things. He was a man with vision and a large goal. And he set out to do those things, and he had the ability to fit the pieces together to make it work. Now, one of the things that I am very likely to do when any plan is started to be formulated is to say, okay, this is what we want to do. And I've even said that to folks that were planning a funeral or a memorial service. Okay, I know the concept. This is what we're going to do. But let's get down to the nuts and bolts. You know, what songs do you like? What scriptures, what family member wants to speak? Let's get a program put together so we can begin to get our hands around this to do it. Talking about things and planning things is good and a good exercise, but you've got to translate the talking into action. And also, many times, you've got to cut a plan up into bite-sized pieces so that you can do one at a time to see to it that you get it done. Sometimes we tend to plan too much and not do enough. My former chairman of the corporation had a book out Who Has the Monkey? And it's all about when a job is being undertaken, who has the final responsibility for getting it done? And I remember one chapter in particular when a subordinate comes in with a problem to the supervisor, okay? And the point of the whole chapter is the problem's not important, okay? The solution to the problem is not important. At the end of the meeting, what's important is who has the monkey. In other words, when a subordinate comes in, is he successful in laying off the responsibility to the superior, or does the superior give him direction and give that responsibility right back to him again, so that when he goes out the door, he's enabled, but he's also responsible? And so I've seen leaders who have a large vision and they know what they want to do, but they can't be bothered with details. The small details are going to be left to somebody else, and that's presuming there is that somebody else to do it. Without major help on the minors, the plan will founder. They're not going to get anywhere. But on the other hand, I've also seen leaders that thrive on micromanagement. They love to manage the details. They love when someone comes and whispers in their ear, giving them information that they think might be withheld from them, and they act on that. But if you manage every little aspect like that, chances are good that you're not going to delegate much and your plan isn't going to move forward. And I've also seen that subordinates will get discouraged and say, you know, I can't make any decisions, I can't change anything. If it's going to be whatever the boss wants, let him just tell me, and then I'll do it. That system doesn't work well either. In this portion, we get a glimpse of Paul in his administrative capacity, and he's doing macro and micro, both. He obviously has a vision. He obviously is not ignoring the details, and he obviously intends to push that ministry forward. And so we start with the collection. He speaks of the collection for the saints in Jerusalem, and the way he speaks tells us that this subject's been discussed before. And from the book of Acts, we know that persecution had arisen to the church in Jerusalem, which scattered it out through the Roman world. And so the collection was a way for the new church, in a material way, to show appreciation for the spiritual things that the church in Jerusalem had started. And so in this case, I want you to remember the Greek word koinonia, It's a Greek term for fellowship or mutual sharing or intimacy, okay? And so in any New Testament church, there should be visible koinonia. Sometimes, of course, with the church acting as a third party in the middle between the giver and the recipient, we can dilute the feeling of sharing. We put money into a box or into a plate, and at the end of the year, the budget shows us where all that money went. But no matter the exact mechanism, and much of our giving in the church and much of our procedure is dictated by various IRS regulations that ensure transparency and accountability in money given and money received. But it's vital to many ministries throughout the world. And so we have our own ministry here in the local church, and we've got also the missionaries scattered abroad. And so giving is part of this whole idea of fellowship, whether we give locally or whether we send it abroad. it's a special sharing. And so I've got a few references here to show you some of the richness in the meaning of the word koinonia, which we really don't have an exact counterpart for that in English. One of the pitfalls of translation. Acts 2:42 says, "And they were continually devoting themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer." Now here the word fellowship is koinonia. Romans 15:26, "For Macedonia and Achaia have been pleased to make a contribution for the poor among the saints in Jerusalem." Now here the word English contribution, koinonia. 1 Corinthians, in our book we're studying right now, 1:9, "God is faithful, through whom you are called into fellowship with his Son, Jesus Christ our Lord." The word fellowship, koinonia. Now, giving was to be regular, first day of every week, which is another little insight into the early church, because Sunday was a significant day, first day of the week, rather than Shabbat or Saturday, which is still used by the Jewish people to this day. And the sense of the word to put aside or lay up seems to indicate some kind of place, a depository, treasury, something to keep the money. Might have been in a central location, although we know they didn't have a church like this church. They met in people's homes. The phrase, "no collections be made when I come," leads us to believe the money would be there and ready for Paul to receive without the need of further collections. "Each one of you," okay, is another phrase that's important. It says, "Each one of you is to put aside and save as he may prosper." And so nobody, great or small, is going to be left out of the giving. And while some may be able to give more, everybody can give something. Remember the widow who gave two small copper coins, and Jesus honored that gift because she gave out of poverty rather than out of abundance. Ministry, in all senses, is not left to the few. It's meant to be shared by all. And while each and every person cannot do everything, everybody can do something. The phrase, "as you may prosper," indicates the gifts were to be different based on the ability to give. Now, if you notice the nuts and bolts of the contribution, there's some good accounting principles in there. There was to be a letter or letters issued to men who would take the collection to Jerusalem, and if it's fitting, Paul will go and they will accompany him. Modern accounting rules often divide responsibilities between people and require periodic audits of the disbursement of funds. And so when I was on the auditing committee to the credit union, one of the things we did is in a given month, we would chase every single check that had been issued out of the account and see where it came from, to whom it was given, and that everything was proper, and that month would be selected at random out of the last 12 months, which was a fair amount of work, but it was some of the things that were done. Unfortunately, money has been the downfall of many a preacher, and we see how carefully Paul ensures that the congregation didn't just hand the money to him. A trusted man or men are going to go along. They'll carry the money. They'll see to it that it's safe during the journey. They'll see to it that it's properly given to the church, probably at that time to James up in Jerusalem. And so it's very interesting to me because from time to time you see a notice in the paper, an audit and so-and-so has embezzled X amount of money from this, that, or the other fund. And of course, everybody's always surprised that this could happen or would happen. Now we get to his itinerary. Paul speaks of his plan to come to them, and he speaks about a desire for a longer visit rather than just a quick stop. Some things take time. And in the case of the ministry, it's necessary to take the time that's needed. If you read the book of Timothy, Paul is exhorting Timothy to preach the gospel in season and out of season. And there are times when things are pressing, okay? A window might open, a heart might be softened, and at the same time, other responsibilities might beckon. There's other things that need to be done. But we must take the time to do a more thorough and a more careful job. I can remember a time visiting somebody in the hospital, and I did not know the man, but I was asked to go see him by one of his friends because he was not doing very well. And so I'm speaking with him, and I'm praying with him, and I have other things on the schedule. I'm getting ready to leave, and there's a man in the next bed because there's two people in that room. And the man in the next bed said, "Well, nobody has come to pray with me." And so I then went over and got his name and spoke with him and and did what I could for him. And these are things that we do, whether it would be in season or out of season. And all ministers have some kind of plan, or perhaps many plans at any given time, things they want to do both in the short term and in the long term. And these plans are subject to change. Joe was very fond of saying, if you're in ministry, you've got to be flexible, so you might have to change things at a moment's notice. And we often do. And also the phrase of sending him on his way anticipates the church going to help him in his further endeavors as he preached all over. And he notes that there's an open door in Ephesus with many adversaries. And of course, in the Greek, the thing you put first in a phrase or sentence is the most important. So the first thing is the open door. With many adversaries is at the end. And he didn't fret too much about the opposition. It's almost taken as a matter of course that where you proclaim the gospel, there's going to be some opposition. And that hasn't changed over the centuries either. If you start proclaiming the gospel, you're going to eventually run into some kind of opposition. I've heard it said, if you don't have any opposition at all, then you're not really doing a good job. Other workers, and that's where this particular text is ending. He speaks of Timothy, and he speaks also of Apollos. And he's admonishing the church, if Timothy comes, essentially saying, be good to him. Let him not have any cause to be afraid. Now, opposition is a deadly poison in the church. Typically, you can see a matter of personalities perhaps rubbing each other the wrong way. I've seen intergenerational opposition, intergenerational strife where, you know, perhaps somebody says, well, you can't change this. Why? We've always done it this way. Or there's an idea of a change in program, perhaps a change in emphasis, and there's intergenerational strife. Personality strife. I've seen that as well. Typically, the root of personality strife tends to be pride. I'm so smart, you should do it my way. I know more than anybody. Why don't you listen to me? And so when pride gets into the picture, then you begin to see strife in ministry and friction between those who are working. And you can see people leaving the church. You can see divides. You can see splits. You can see pastors leaving. I've seen all these things, much to my sorrow, as a matter of fact. And so this is an echo of the fact that Corinth was the troubled church. Why would Paul need to remind them to receive Timothy? Except that there are some of these things going on in the Corinthian church. Opposition, dispute, a little strife, personalities. And you see it in the very first chapter when one says, I'm of Apollos. Another one says, I'm of Cephas. Another one says, well, I'm following Paul. And Paul comes back and says, he doesn't say, oh, you should always follow me. He says, was I crucified for you? We're all workers. We're all workers, and we're workers under Christ. You know, and that's where you need to follow, not some individual. It's interesting to me also that Paul says, he is doing the Lord's work as I also am. Paul makes Timothy equal with him. Now, Paul had a fabulous amount of knowledge and learning in the Old Testament. We know he studied with Gamaliel, and we know that he was a Pharisee, very sharp. But this is a great truth. It shouldn't be passed over lightly. All those who work for the Lord are working according to their own ability. And we see this as a thread also where he says, as you have prospered, give. Now he says, Timothy's doing the Lord's work just like me. Now, Timothy might not have had the skill and ability that Paul had, but he was working according to his own ability for the Lord, and as such deserved to be respected and received. Because the workers, I'm in communication, you know, by email with a number of people around the world, and they're all working according to their own ability, wherever they can. So the pastor in Africa, you know, he'd like to get a motorbike so he doesn't have to walk out to preach in various villages. The pastor in India is trying to scrape together money to buy 20-pound bags of rice because people are starving over there. And we have the Whitmans, of course, on deputation from Italy, but Italy has a whole different set of issues, as does South America. And so they're all working in their own little corner and doing as best they can. And so Paul is telling the church the same thing I would say to this church when we receive a native pastor through IGM and they come down to speak. There should be a good feeling in the room. There shouldn't be any indifference to the person's ministry. There shouldn't be any hostility to the person's ministry. But our goal is to what? Send them on their way and help them to the best of our ability and see if we can encourage them while they encourage us. It's a tremendous, tremendous difference in ministry over the world, a tremendous difference in living standards over the world, where people are doing ministry. And in Africa, people are doing ministry walking and riding on bicycles. And they make do with far less than what we consider the minimum. Evidently, Paul had also desired to send Apollos with Timothy, but Apollos did not desire to come at all. Now, here's a little peek at some difference of opinion, and Paul could not order Apollos to go. And that's another principle that needs to be remembered. In the corporate world, you can tell someone, you must do this. If you don't do it, I'm going to have to let you go. Or you must do better in this area. Or this has to be done by the first of the year or the first of the month. But in the volunteer world, where we live in the church, it's a whole different set of facts and a whole different set of guidelines. You can encourage someone to do something. You can ask someone to do something. But guess what? You really can't fire a volunteer. Now, we're not told exactly why Apollos could have been upset that they were using him and his teaching as a wedge to divide the church, as we saw in the first chapter of Corinthians. But whatever the reason, the only promise that Apollos would make is he would come to Corinth when he got the opportunity. As we work in ministry, other people are not always going to see things our way. And there could be many reasons for it. But if you're on a ministry team and they decide to take a path you don't care for, not only is it possible, it's likely. And you are then obliged to help them along the way to see if, even though you may not agree with what's being done or exactly how, to see if there can't be some fruit in that pursuit, to see if something good can happen. Because although it is totally amazing to the human mind, we can be wrong. Seems fantastic, but sometimes someone else can have a better idea. Or there could be several good ideas, and perhaps they don't select the one we like. The work is important, though, and it's also important that the work not suffer through difference of opinion. If you go back in history, at one time there was one pope in France, there was another pope in Italy. Both claimed to be the true pope. Both excommunicated the other. There's some very interesting facts that I can't get into at this time, but differences of opinion. And we have differences of opinion between our church and other churches. But quite honestly, if they invited me to speak in one of these other churches that has differences of opinion, I would go. As long as they didn't constrain me on what I could speak about, I would go. Because I'm more interested in the things we have in common and worship of God and the Messiah, Jesus Christ. I'm more interested in that than I am interested in the fine print of the things that might divide us. So here Paul mentions he would have preferred Apollos to come with Timothy, but it didn't happen, nor does he criticize Apollos for that. My dear old dad once upon a time told me that some of the fundamental churches, when they got to heaven and they looked across the River Jordan, they looked over there and they saw there was Methodists over there and Presbyterians over there and other congregants over there. He said, they will camp at the River Jordan on the other side, and they won't cross into the Promised Land because they think it's only for them. Of course, I've spoken of my dad before. He was a very unique man and had a unique way of putting things. But that's not what we want to do. And so, as I say, as we go forward in ministry, if you remember nothing else, we should never let our differences divide us to the point where it's a hindrance to the ministry, because the ministry is more important than the individual or the pride from the individual or the preferences of the individual. We all have them. We all have them. But if we're going to go forward, we need to get past or over some of them. And I'll end on that thought. Our closing hymn is number 442.